welcome to the Hope Show, Gabfest. Myself and Michael are here again to talk about punk rock 1981. We picked five songs each. We have 10 songs. We could have easily have had 20. Easy. Probably 20 each in reality. And God, it's getting more difficult, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah, it's getting no easier. And you're completely right. We could have had 20 or 30 each.
We've got 1981 now, so we've done 76 to 80. 76 punk kind of starting, and now 81, it's well and truly, or as you said last week, going underground was that kind of last song of the original or the initial phase, maybe. So it's gone off in a number of different directions. So we'll probably be taking those in on tonight's show. Should we start with the first song, will we? And which certainly shows the direction that it went off in. And this is Altered Images, Dead Pop Stars. Altered Images there, Michael. Dead Pop Stars. One thing I'm really enjoying about this is when we pick our five songs, and then this came up and I was like, oh my God, yeah, I remember that song. Excellent song. Do you want to kind of go into a bit why you thought we needed to include it, or a bit about that song?
Absolutely. When I first heard this song, I didn't know what to make of it. I thought, this is extraordinary because it's this little girl voice you know, this isn't the voice of, you know, some macho guy talking about dead pop stars or old pop stars or the past. And a lot of what was exciting about punk was that it said, we're new, we're now, we're in the moment, and everything that happened before, like the Clash in 1977 with the No Elvis Beatles and the Rolling Stones, you know, that's, you know, throw out your record collection and start anew. But that's really different when you hear it from a woman, and especially from a woman with a girly voice. And there's so much about this song that I love that I'll find it difficult to stop talking about it, to be honest.
Well, but keep going for a little while anyway.
Yeah, thanks. It shows the accessibility of that movement, that here was a group of young people in Scotland who apparently were members of the Susie and the Banshees fan club. Yeah. And wrote to the Banshees saying, we see you're going on tour, can we open for you in Scotland?
Yeah, amazing.
And the Banshees wrote back saying, oh, we love your tape, and yeah, you can have the whole tour.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that actually happened, but it's a brilliant story of DIY. And then Steve Severin produces this song and produces the debut album. I think they revisited Happy Birthday. And Happy Birthday is an extraordinary pop song, and Happy Birthday is a happy song.
Yeah.
And this is the same group with a song that's anything but happy. Yeah.
Same year, same
people. It's extraordinary. And to me, this shows that by 1981, that immediate impulse to create, for young people in particular, to create, has absolutely unleashed incredibly heavy statements, because this to me is a statement about consumerism. It's a statement about the pop music industry, about objectification, the posters on the wall, but it's from the woman's perspective. And I just don't know anything from a group that could have a big chart hit with Happy Birthday that's got that same razor edge attack.
Yeah.
I think it's extraordinary. And the John Peel session probably was the first time I heard this. It's scary and intense.
Yeah.
And when you think of what Gary Glitter represented, when you think of what glam rock represented, or the people who would have been making punk music in this era, this to me, it's a couple of Gary Glitter references, very clear references. He's not dead when they write this, gosh, they're burying him alive. So I think this is one of the scariest pop songs that I've ever heard.
Debut single. What a great way to make your mark. I know they had the Peel session before that, but it was their debut single. And you can hear the Susie and the Banshees link, or the influence there. They'd six top 40s, and that wasn't one of them.
No, that was a, you know, because they're on Epic, they're on Sony. So this would have been viewed as a flop, but I remember buying it. It looks beautiful. Yeah. The B-side is fantastic as well. And didn't betray any hint of the fact that this was a band that was going to, you know, be, you know, the best new act, I think, in The Enemy and in Smash Hits.
Yeah.
This was a world apart. Yeah. And to me, this was the potency of punk.
Yeah, exactly. And they were, the name comes, it's got some link to the Buzzcocks Promises, Altered Images, something to do with the design of the sleeve on Promises. Was some sort of altered image or something like that.
And yeah,
that's where the name.
We mentioned Malcolm Garrett, who did it, and his company was called Assorted Images. And maybe they looked at that and thought, okay, that's a cool name, and let's change it a little bit.
Great song. Great start. Yeah. Okay, well, a little bit of a departure. Next, we are going across the Atlantic for the next song to Washington, D.C. And this is Minor Threat, Straight Edge. Later, it's done. Fantastic. To me, that's just incredible. It's a different sound. We spoke about what's out there happening. You know, throw away all your old records. Minor Threat and the influence that this band have had on music following on from 1981 is just massive. And there's threads all over music ever since. And it's just an attack. It's just a gang of kids going, yeah, we're punks. Yeah, right. We're going to get on stage. We're going to do what we want. We're going to sing this. But you know what? We're not going to be like you. We're going to be the way we are. We're not going to try and shock you. You know, we've had enough of all that shock. Yeah, go on off drinking. We don't drink. That's okay. And to me, you know, like punk was on about speaking up for minorities in many ways, you know, and equality, as we've mentioned about equality as well. And as somebody who was sitting in Dublin, not wanting to drink alcohol in Ireland, not wanting to drink alcohol, you're already on the edge. You're already kind of cast with some sort of aspersion or some sort of suspiciousness. It's bizarre, and I was one of those people, you know. And to hear a band singing, going, yeah, we don't drink, and, you know, I've got Straight Edge. It wasn't even that you had to become part of a movement. It was just these can speak for me, you know, in the same way as maybe the Clash spoke politics or Crass became into political. These were just people going, you know, it's okay to be yourself. And get out and be in a band. 47 seconds. To me, that changed the world. And it's only 47 seconds long.
Seriously, Niall, it changed your world.
Yeah. Like, I'm almost feeling passionate even talking about it. So it didn't make me, it didn't turn me, do you know what I mean? But it opened up the gate that I was trying to climb over. It's okay, this fella in Washington DC who's singing a song in a band saying it's okay not to drink, then it's okay for me not to drink, you know, while everyone around me is drinking alcohol.
And were you aware of this at the time, Niall? Like, how was this on your radar?
So in 1981 it wouldn't have been, but when I heard it first, you know, which would have been probably 83, 84. That's when it was like, wow, incredible. Because it was probably 84 when I think that's when an album came out, a Minor Threat album, like a retrospective album came out then at that stage. And that's when it got on my radar and was like, wow, yeah, this is somebody speaking directly to me.
Yeah. And likewise for me, I would have read Maximum Rock and Roll very, very occasionally because it was very hard to come by and it was incredibly expensive. Magazines were really, really dear in Ireland. So you'd go in and you'd try and have a little look at them in Easons, but people didn't want you reading them, the staff, because there'd be a bunch of people standing around reading the magazines. John Fleming wrote about it recently when he was talking about his cassette culture. And I thought that American hardcore was really, really interesting because I am I ashamed to say this? No, I'm actually proud to say it. I hated rock music. Like, I thought rock music was crap. I didn't like heavy metal at all. You know, so I came into punk, and I suspect other people of my age did as well, through pop music, through David Bowie. It wasn't through heavy metal. I didn't need to cut my hair and get rid of my status quo or Thin Lizzy patches, because that had nothing to do with my world. So in a way, punk exposed me to the aggression and the speed of what people, what I would have thought of as heavy metal, but that was coming from rock music. And that was, it seemed a bit raucous. It seemed a bit macho, a bit kind of, hey, we're all lads together having fun together. So this statement to me was extraordinary. And I never felt that this band were preachy, to be honest. I know they've been labeled, oh, they were preaching, they were saying what to do. I never felt that. I thought Meatloaf were just as preachy, you know, with what they were saying. As if there were, you know, this seemed like commentary from young people who seemed to be having a good time. And who seemed to be organized enough to go into, to write a song, go on tour, record it, and put it out for people like me in suburban Dublin to eventually hear it and think, that's great. Like, that's really exciting. And what are they saying? Because I'm attracted by the excitement. So I think this is a phenomenal piece of culture. And it's great fun. I genuinely think this is great fun. I don't think it's Old Testament, biblical finger wagging. I could be misinterpreted, but I think it's...
Yeah, well, same here. I never felt it was some band trying to preach, saying, do as I do. I felt it was like somebody saying, this is what I am, you know? And to me, that's what the difference was, that they weren't trying to, you know, go, oh, you cannot, you know, because I know Straight Edge then became, well, maybe a bit of a movement, and then the bands became this, you know, where nearly preachy, you know, where nearly most of their songs then became about, you know, being straight, and it then became almost like people who did drink were going, oh, I'm uncomfortable being here, you know, and I was like, well, that's how I feel around you all the time, but yeah, you're right, it shouldn't be like that for either of us. And I wouldn't have felt that Minor Threat were, well, because they probably, because it was just a singer maybe that didn't drink, you know, because, you know, there wasn't a whole band, it wasn't a way of life for them, you know, it was just, this is one of our songs, you know, but huge influence.
And musically, I find this so potent. This gives me, and certainly at the time that I first came across it, it gave me the type of thrill that Napalm Death later did, where you think, how is that even possible? You
know, it's fast,
it's loud, it's aggressive, it's compelling, and it's a bit scary as well, which, you know, makes it fun. So I think that this was, the Americans, I think, what they did to punk rock really allowed it to last.
Terrific. And speaking of which, we have another American band up next, which does this have Rollins singing at this stage? Maybe. No, has he joined yet? We'll talk about it.
Listen to it and see if you can hear.
Yeah, let's play it. Let's play it. Six Pack, Black Flag.
Thank you.
Now, to me, that's a song that would make you want to go straight edge rather than straight edge itself. Anyway, Black Flag six pack. What do you remember of it?
I remember thinking that the line, I was born with a bottle in my mouth, now I've got six, so I'll never run out, was every bit as funny and brilliant and twisted and perverse as the Ramones, it's the end of the 70s, it's the end of the century. You know, it's nonsense, but it's brilliant. It, to me, it's great writing. It's great comic writing. And I see in Black Flag, and it's just me, this is just my personal opinion, I see Family Guy. I see and hear The Simpsons. That kind of very, very sarcastic satire of mainstream American life. And I think this is so funny. But it's really funny, and the music's really aggressive, not the way that the Dickies were, because I thought the Dickies, the music matched the lyrics. But this, to me, showed that punk could really, really pack a punch, but that they're also really funny, that there was a lot of joy in this. It sounds like it would have been difficult to compose this, because it sounds simple, and those things are always complex. But this really made me feel that Dublin was a completely different world than America in particular. London felt very far away. Liverpool felt far away. But America and American punk, that was, it felt as far away as Starsky and Hutch to me. You know, it her tune makes it sound like it was silly, but it was intense and vibrant and exciting, but it really felt so far away from me. And this song didn't sound like anything that I was coming across in my world in Ireland of going to see bands. I loved it then, and I still love it. And I was kind of a bargain. I didn't have a lot of money for buying records. I was a student for a lot of the early 80s. So I wouldn't have had loads of money. So I tended to buy records that were cheap rather than records that were good. Right. And I will never, ever forget how strange I felt walking out of Golden Discs in ILAC Centre, you know, where they had all of those 80s, the types of clothes that then became associated with Frankie Goes to Hollywood, or you know, with kind of lads who dressed up,
the shoulder pads,
you know, and their finery, but they looked like they'd kick the crap out of you. Like it just, it made no sense to me. But buying this record, buying the album, damaged in because it was half price. But I just felt like I'd won the lottery, that I'd got something really sacred that just didn't belong in the ILAC Centre. I kind of felt I was rescued from a life of having to be near records that didn't deserve to be in the same shop as it.
And the artwork again is incredible, isn't it? You know,
the aggression, but to me, and you understand it much better than I do, Niall, I thought the aggression of the American bands was really, really different to the aggression of the bands from London, like some of the ones that you've selected as being, this is worth looking at in the context of 1980 and what happened after it.
For sure. You know, because that was Cockney Rejects last week, and the next band as well are very similar to from Scotland. And, you know, Black Flag, there's an aggression, but there's also like, come on, you know, you can get up on stage with me, or you can, you know, we're all part of this. It didn't seem to quite be like, it didn't seem to be quite like that with the other bands. It seemed to be more like a survival of the fittest with some of the other aggressive music. So with maybe Black Flag, or say Minor Threat, and I know there was a lot of there was a lot of fighting going on even then. And, you know, like there was the New York crew and the Washington DC crew. There's infamous kind of talk of, you know, battles between them and fights. But it just seemed like that you could be in their gang, whereas it just didn't. There was a certain kind of standoffishness or whatever about some of the UK bands, I think. Anyway, will we have a listen to the next song, or close our ears for 1:55 in some cases? But anyway, this is 1981.
You love it.
This is 1981. It's punk rock, Top of the Pops. This is The Exploited. So this takes me right back. I remember seeing The Exploited on Top of the Pops and going, oh, this is just brilliant. I'm not sure now would I kind of be going, oh, lovely, there's The Exploited on a mainstream TV show or whatever. But it just seemed to be like, I don't know, because at that stage, maybe not every song on Top of the Pops was good. A couple of years before that, you know, there was a lot more good songs than bad songs on Top of the Pops. But at that stage, it was kind of gone a bit like, you know, some of the charts was a little bit and The Exploited was, I don't know, maybe a freshness to it. It's punk in the vein of the Pistols. So we spoke about that kind of first, you know, chapter closing, but The Exploited are more a kind of Pistols band than anything else. I think the album Punk's Not Dead was just a statement in itself, and I was very happy to see that. I was 13, so you know, I wasn't thinking about, you know, hidden meanings and anything or whatever. It was like, wow, The Exploited say Punk's Not Dead. It became the rallying cry. Yeah, Punk's Not Dead, you know. Punk was starting to come into two sides now, you know. Well, we're going through it here, and there's probably 10 different veins from what we're playing tonight. But, you know, there was the peace punks, you know, you're either on the crass side or you're on The Exploited, the street punk side. And I was going, hang on a second, I kind of like crass, but I kind of like The Exploited as well. So I don't really want to be on either side. But of course, they were all attacking each other, and there was something completely different going on. I never wanted to spike my hair. I never wanted a Mohican. I never wanted to be like Waddy. But I thought Dublin was a dead city. And I thought that The Exploited were singing about some place like Dublin. Now, they may or may not have been singing about anything. I may not have any other meaning. But I was going, dead city, yeah, that's Dublin. Dublin's a dead city. you know, and Punk's not dead. Let's go. You know, let's smash the system. You know, you have to think about it then a little bit deeper after that, you know, because in reality, do you really want to smash the system? Like, what is it that you're trying to do? That's a different argument, I suppose. But the exploited, to me, just brought a freshness there. And for 6 months of that year, I was going, yeah, Punk's not dead. This is great.
And obviously the slogan, you know, Punk's not dead. The fact that they had to say that and spray it on a wall, you know, to me, I really think that youth cultures only have a lifespan of 3 years and then a new generation comes on. I think there's no bigger leap in life than the leap from when you're 16 to when you're 20. You know, they're different, completely different worlds. And to me, that this was people saying, we're not the 77 gang, but we're saying that something about them, something of that spirit is alive, and we want to carry the torch for that. And you mentioned them on Top of the Pops, and the same week they were on Top of the Pops, the tweets were on with the birdie. Was it the birdie song or the birdie dance?
Yeah, the birdie song, yeah.
But so was Toy, and so were Altered Images, Squeeze were on as well. So the tribes were coming together, and this, you know, to me was the leather and the bristles brigade, which hadn't been so prominent in early punk, where people like Shane McGowan and you know, you had ripped t-shirts, you had the bin liners, but this really was becoming, I think, the kind of the territorial look of the punk subculture that you still see around.
Yeah.
You know, and that's extraordinary to me.
Yeah.
That's where this is significant in terms of culture.
In terms of culture, for sure. Okay. Well, let's move on. And by the time 1981 came around, I think Susie and the Banshees were on their fourth album. So Susie and the Banshees are up next, and this is Spellbound from Juju.
From the cradle bars comes a beckoning voice that sends spinning. You have no choice. You hear laughter cracking through the walls, it's been spinning. You have no choice, you hear laughter.
Great stuff. Great stuff. So four albums in 1981, a band that couldn't play their instruments at the start and just got up on stage at a, it's just a great story, isn't it?
Yeah. There's Dead Cities for you, Noel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Susie and the Banshees to me are one of the greatest pop bands. They're one of the greatest rock bands in history. They're one of the most innovative. They're one of the most creative. They're one of the most fascinating. They're one of the most changeable. So does this sound like punk? If you were to dissect it, you wouldn't say that's punk. You wouldn't put it in the punk box. But I think Susie and the Banshees are incredibly underrated. Their influence, their cultural footprint is underrated because they moved sonically so quickly away from that first impulse of the 100 Club gig that they got up and did quite spontaneously. But their sophistication is still, to me, rooted in that first impulse. You know, would they have existed if it was all Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Status Quo and Pink Floyd, and then all the really crap nightclub, sleazy entertainment that the BBC Top of the Pops selectors would have preferred that you were watching. And I think of this in 1981, and that a decade later, in 1991, that when Lollapalooza tour, the first one that Jane's Addiction put together, that Rollins, who's come from Black Flag, is on the bill. Ice-T is on, Living Colour, Nine Inch Nails. And to me, it's proof that pure impulse to create music, even if you didn't feel qualified, even if you didn't feel that you'd find an audience, that really made a difference to culture. Yeah. And I think that's a marvelous song. And I remember the first time I heard it. And it's one of those songs when it ends, you just think, I can't believe it's over. Because it's just that compelling. It brings you up and down. And I love her voice and I love their sound.
Yeah, yeah. As you said,
Sanders constantly involved.
Constantly evolving, compelling. We spoke about it last time. Was it last time about the sound that they created and just kind of almost a fear or whatever, a primal beat, you know. And you're singing along to a song. I've no idea what it's about, to be honest, but I'm singing along, you know, and like getting so like it. It's intriguing and it's just captivates you. And you know, to think it's the fourth album in and they're still, you know, producing such constantly incredible songs. It's great.
A lot different.
A lot different to Dead Cities.
That's it. And they were on Top of the Pops with the Exploited when they did Dead Cities, but with their side project, The Creature. So these people were just so creative. That says a lot about discipline. And people think, oh, punk is just, you know, nonsense and crap and shouting.
Yeah.
But
the
discipline that you have to go into the studio, you have to do the work. And God, these people did the work.
They sure did. All right, well, let's move on. We'll come over to Ireland now next. Ireland's still producing music in 1981, so let's go with Nun Attacks and White Cortina.
The next song is about psychiatrists and stuff and rubbish, and it's called White Cortina.
So, None Attacks there from the Cot of the Campus compilation, live compilation, 1981. And there's a few reasons I wanted to include this one tonight. The fact that it was live at the campus, and so Elvira and all the work that Elvira was doing down in Cork. This was my introduction. This was the first I heard about whatever was going on down there. My brothers came in with this, and there was something about that sound, that quirky, I don't know, jazzy kind of sound, that guitar, kind of trebly guitar that went on with other bands, that influenced a lot of other bands, and other bands started playing. So it's that kind of post-punk thing with the post-punk jazz kind of sound. And then obviously None Attacks go on, Five Go Down to the Sea, Beethoven, and then there's the tragic story of the singer dying, Finbar Donnelly, at 27. So, and I think it was important for us to reflect all that. And, you know, to me, the best way to do that was through the None Attacks song, White Cortina. At the time, my dad had a green Cortina. and so my memory of it is singing along and going, oh, if only you had a white one, Dad. You know, we put that song on and he was like, oh, get that rubbish off. But, you know, even us doing that was almost like a highlight of a day. Or here's me dad, I'm going to put on White Cortina. You know, how strange is that? But, yeah, I just thought, you know, it's important for us, especially to reflect what Elvira was doing with the campus and, you know, in memory of Finbar Donnelly.
Yeah, brilliant song, brilliant band. And probably the first 12-inch single that I ever bought of Irish music. I don't ever remember buying a 12-inch. You know, to me, 12-inches were for big bands, for foreign bands. And then out comes this 12-inch single from Cork.
Yeah, yeah.
And from, as you mentioned, from Elvira Butler's club that used to pack people in while being alcohol free. It's just extraordinary story. And she helped all the local bands and gave them opportunities to open for the big bands like The Fall and the Psychedelic Furs and the Skids who came to Cork, The Cure. And I think this is a great piece of songwriting, and I think it's got loads of attitude. It's also very, very funny. And you mentioned the word quirky, that the Cork bands are often called quirky. But to me, the Cork bands were far more in tune with the creativity of people like the Three Johns and that whole decade of great independent music that was happening across the water. And in Dublin, people were saturated probably from Thin Lizzy's days. And then the Boomtown Rats came along, and suddenly the Boomtown Rats were pop stars very, very quickly, with extraordinary success for a local band. So I think that bands in Dublin thought, let's write songs to make us famous very, very quickly. Whereas I think the more interesting bands, and maybe the bands that have stood the test of time a bit better, were the bands that thought, no, let's not write songs that sound conventional. Let's do something that's really interesting and different. And this was great. And I don't know if you saw remember Saturday morning television, RTE, which wouldn't have been the most cutting edge. And the None Attacks are on.
Yeah.
And there's a White Cortina in the studio. And they're beating the crap out of it. And never ever seen it. It was very, very inspiring. It was inspiring to my own brief and dreadful music career. But when I was in a band, I would say inspired by that, we got a car door and we brought it on stage, and for the last, you know, we used to pound it with bits of metal. And for the grand finale, we wound up the window and smashed it on the stage at the Project Arts Center.
Yeah, yeah.
Rightfully never got invited back. But, you know, those bands just showed that you could do anything, and it opened loads of doors for me, and it made me think about things in a new way. So I was delighted that you chose that, Noel.
And again, it's that making you think about music in a different way. And you know, and that certainly, non-attacks and bands like that certainly did for me anyway. Okay, we move on to Rig and Panic next. And Go, 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 This Is It. So it's not far from the kind of the free jazz funky madness of Nun Attack's Five Go Down to the Sea, or, you know, Stump, and maybe what Big Flame then became. People from the pop group went on to start Rip, Rig and Panic. This is kind of new enough to me. I haven't heard too much from them. I want to call them Rip Pig and Panic for some reason, but it's Rip, Rig and Panic. Well, how come they ended up in here for yourself?
Just because I think it's one of my five favorite songs of that era, and the pop group scared me even more than Crass scared me. That the song "We Are All Prostitutes" is still sends chills down my spine, beyond good and evil. Very, very potent and heavy and exciting and thrilling, scary, scary music. And I think that the one ingredient that was missing from punk when it started was soul music, was black soul music, which, you know, was kind of the other music that I loved. And Rip, Rig and Panic and the pop group to a lesser extent brought that in. And, you know, this is Nina Cherry singing this. Mm-hmm. And when they brought out the album, and, you know, again, it arrived, John, my brother, brought it home. It wasn't A and B sides. They were color coded, and it was two records, and there was a red and a blue and a yellow and a green.
Yeah, so double album. Double album, yeah.
Yeah. But it was funky and it was cool, and I don't know if I would have understood or appreciated funk music or jazz music. I certainly didn't at the time, but I don't know if I would have appreciated it without knowing that the pop group, who I viewed as a punk group, that they say it's cool. You know, they do a bit of that, so I can listen to
jazz.
So I really think that for me personally, they opened up lots of doors of dance music and of great music that you know has stood the test of time. And this just it seems to anticipate a lot of the to me I can hear pop will eat itself before they exist, you know, but this kind of it just seems like it's cut up some bits of stuff thrown together, but it's utterly, utterly compelling to me. I loved this at the time and I still do. And I think this was Punk's Not Dead is 1981 slogan. But you know, these people are saying and showing that whatever you think punk is, it's much bigger than a four-letter word. There's lots of don't be limited.
Yeah, yeah. Remind me of the Nightingales a little bit, who obviously came after that. But it is that where, you know, don't be limited, play different styles. Don't just stick to the kind of, you know, the three chords, you know, bang, bang, bang. Get out there and do whatever you can with your sound. And yeah, it's great. Another band that kind of did a few strange things with their sound is Flipper. So we have them next. And this is from the Let Them Eat Jelly Beans compilation that came out in 81. This is Flipper. Ha, ha, ha. That's Flipper, ha ha ha, from the Let Them Eat Jelly Beans compilation, that Alternative Tentacles released in 81. And you know, it's erratic and it's avant-garde sound, but it's challenging you. And to me, you know, punk rock was like, you know, you're questioning everything. Was that kind of, you know, that symbol, question everything, you know, that Crass would have said, you know. But it wasn't just question your surroundings. It was question what you listen to. For me, you know, that's what I started doing. Then I started kind of questioning, going, all right, I'll start, you know, it's not just this straight ahead music. And the Let Them Eat Jelly Beans compilation, I think I probably heard it, it was probably about 83 when I heard it first. But you know, it's got like, that's the first song on it. And you know, as an opening track, I'm like, whoa, what's going on here? What's this band trying to do? And then after that, you've DOA. Then after that, it's Black Flag. Then it's Bad Brains. Then it's the Dead Kennedys, Circle Jerks. And, you know, there's other stuff on it, you know, the Feeders and the Subhumans and Christian Lunch on the other side. But, you know, those first six songs on that compilation album is like, this is, you know, what's going on over here in the States? You know, what's going on with all this music? And I think for me, that kind of got me really interested in hardcore in the States, you know, those six songs on that. And then I saw Flipper did their 40 year reunion tour, you know, and Flipper, I think two of their vocalists have died, you know, in the 40 years, but David Yao from Jesus Lizard was singing, Mike Watt was playing bass, and they're standing there, and it was still challenging to listen to them, which to me, it speaks volumes, you know, still 40 years, but those songs, they're good, you know, they're great. They bring you in, but it's challenging to listen to.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Niall. And, you know, when I talk about hardcore, I sometimes forget just how diverse that field actually was. And you know, compilation albums were really important. And, you know, if they were on a compilation record or if they were on Alternative Tentacles, I thought, oh, they must be good, because I trust that label. And the early tracks on this compilation really just were such a powerful statement, but incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of creativity that doesn't get remembered, because we tend to remember the overall sound as it evolved. But lots of these people sound like they're having fun and they were doing something different and they were stretching their own limitations, and it's great. And as you say, these bands lasted. Like, these bands, their legacy wasn't, oh yeah, we made some records 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Their legacy was, and we've been touring in various, you know, groups ever since.
Yeah, yeah.
They're terrific. Gosh, America, without those American bands putting out those early records,
yeah,
very, very hard to consider what would have happened.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, with the diverse sound of hardcore, there's more interesting, well, I don't know, there's a wider range of interest in music starting to appear then, you know, Butthole Surfers or whatever that comes from that as well, you know, and stuff like then is happening in Texas or whatever. So, you know, it's like we see these different roads are appearing, you know, the different strands are starting to appear that all link back to this punk rock thing somehow, but it's still a completely different sound throughout. Okay, let's go on to, we've two tracks left. Next one is Gang of Four, To Hell with Poverty, which we play it and we'll have a little chat then after that.
Thank you.
So bringing punk rock to the dance floor, Gang of Four, To Hell with Poverty. I suppose we have to mention that Andy Gill, died February last year. Organ failure and pneumonia. And, some people have, I think they played in China in November 2019. And it's, some people are saying that maybe Andy Gill, there was a report. I don't want to sound like Donald Trump there by saying some people are saying, but there was a report that Andy Gill died of COVID. So he would have been one of the early deaths, but a terrible tragedy, 64 years old. But great band, what a legacy.
Yeah, incredible band. And as you said, this is dance music. This is disco. This is where disco music has mutated into something that can embrace feedback. This is disco dripping with feedback and anti-capitalist sentiment. It's pure joy, it's pure aggression, and it's completely, completely danceable as well. I think this is great. The snare, I don't know if it's the snare and the cymbal combined, they've ripped the top of your head off. It's got a whole load of bass, and I think this is it. I had it on 12-inch single, and it just made any room, even if you're listening to it on headphones, it just made the world feel huge. I think it's an extraordinary piece of vinyl. Very, very exciting. Produced, I believe, by a guy called Nick Launay, who worked with Killing Joke and The Slits and The Birthday Party and The Virgin Prunes. So he did loads of really important alternative bands who sounded like they should be in the disco if they didn't look like and say what they said. He did a couple of bands that I liked that no one else seemed to like, a band called Positive Noise and Cuban Heels, Ultimate Scotland. He did a bit of Public Image Limited. But I think the sound of some of these records gets forgotten about in terms, how well produced they were, how technically great they sounded. I love this. I love the band, but I think there was a lot more to them than just the first album.
Yeah, you sure? Yeah. And again, I had the 12-inch as well, and put that needle on the record, turn the volume up, and it does fill the whole room with sound, doesn't it? Yeah, brilliant. Okay, Michael, we're on to the last one. This is one that means an awful lot to me. Should we play it and we'll have a little chat and we'll explain a bit more about it then? This is Flux of Pink Indians, Tube Disaster.
Joe
So from the New Smell 7-inch that came out on Crass Records, that's Flux of Pink Indians. That's the band that made me want to go vegetarian. That's they had a lyric, you know. I grew up it was Catholic Ireland, wasn't it? You know, back in the early 80s, and animals didn't have souls was what, you know, that was the kind of thing that said, you know, humans have souls and animals don't have souls, so it's okay to eat animals because they, you know, in the pecking order they mean less. And what the line of Flux Pink Indians line is, "My soul for the sole of your shoe." It's a, you know, speaking as a, you know, from the point of view of a cow or whatever. And that line has stuck with me 40 years of my life, "My soul for the sole of your shoe," because it was just a convenient way that we can use animals for, you know, to eat, wear, or experiment on. And that became a kind of recurring theme through the Crass label, you know, with Andy T and that line, "Animals are not ours to eat, wear, or experiment on." It became a lot more political and a lot more direct. And so punk has gone down this road, or this part of punk has gone down here, and Flux of Pink Indians are on the way, and then Conflict will be, and the Subhumans will be. But I called my band Vicarious Living because of the line in that song, "Vicarious Living cures your boredom." And I remember the 7-inch. My brother bought the 7-inch golden discs, I think, in Liffey Street. Got the 7-inch, brought it home, and I just went, "Oh, this is mine. This is my Bible now." You know, gatefold sleeve, the black and white, and you're just reading through everything, taking it all in, absorbing it. You know, I'm at a young age, so I'm ready. You know, my mind is open. You know, we played The Exploited earlier on, and yeah, I thought Dublin was a dead city, but I thought Flux of Pink Indians were going to show me the way out of the city, you know, and here's the future, and here's what we can try and do, you know. And then they released their album. They call it "Strive to Survive, Causing Least Suffering Possible." I'm going, that's the way you just live, you know. That's it in a nutshell, you know. So Flux were just hugely influential for, you know, a young boy, for me as a young boy, forming opinions in Dublin. And again, they brought out, you know, Spiderleg Records, then they create their own label and start bringing bands on that label, and then become One Little Indian, and causing, you know, which has huge influence. So a really important band in that whole story, I think, you know. And they have had a huge part to play in what has happened in, you know, the ensuing 40 years. Again, you know, maybe it's basic enough sound, but it's a good sound, I think, and I'm still bopping my head along, you know. Just the memory of having that 7-inch and opening it up and reading it, it was just so important for me as a young boy to have that positive influence.
Noel, would you say that Flux were every bit as important and influential as Crass, but they don't get remembered quite as much?
I would think so. Yes, I would think so. And I think maybe because of the, you know, they became Haute Alatio at one stage, and it seemed like they were trying to, you know, maybe become a bit more successful, that they were refining their sound. And maybe because of that, it's kind of, they're not spoken about in the same tones, but to me they are. Now, but Crass were leading the way. Sure, you know, Crass were doing all the things, and Crass were, you know, leading the charge on that. But like, Flux, what they did, I think, are just as influential, yeah.
And did you ever get to see them live, or was it?
No, never.
So again, it was something that if you're in Ireland, you were cut off from this directly.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, cut off. Crass got to Ireland. I was too young to get to see them play, but Flux never got over. No.
Yeah, that. I came to them late. Like, I certainly wasn't listening to them actively in 1981, but I thought that they didn't just release records. They released manifestos in a way. Like, yeah. They articulated their thoughts. It wasn't hey, you know, we've written a song. Let's lash it out in a on a piece of plastic. They really showed the care that DIY could entail if you took it to a very high level.
Yeah.
That you could be very creative and that you could, you know, pack it with information and try and inspire and influence people rather than just get them to buy a piece of product.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a lot of thought went into that whole, you know, record, all the records, a lot of thought went into them and what was on them. So, yeah, you know, we played 10 songs there, all pretty much completely different. Maybe the hardcore, maybe Black Flag and Minor Threat might be lumped in together, you know, from a hardcore thing. Maybe Rip Rig and Panic might be lumped in with Nun Attacks from that kind of funky type stuff. But what a, you know, what a divergence of sound all emanating from, you know, 1976, really. And in our list originally, and I have it written down here, we'd Killin' Joke, we'd The Undertones, we'd Dexys, we'd The Specials, we'd The Au Pairs, we'd Vice Squad, and we'd The Clash, who all deserve a bit of, you know, a mention for what they were doing that year. But, you know, we couldn't fit it in, so we went with those 10 because we thought, like, that's where it was heading that time in 81. Good fun, Michael.
Brilliant, Noel. Brilliant. An explosive year, and as he's mentioned, the diversity is staggering. And then you've got people who are also saying this is what punk means, even though it really only has existed for 3, maybe 4 years. You've got people who are now saying, look, you may have forgotten what this was all about, and we're saying this is what it's about. And then you've got other people who are saying it's not about that at all. It's a completely scattered, splintered movement at this stage. Yeah. Thrilling.
Yeah, brilliant. And the Exploited are saying punk's not dead. Excellent. Okay, well, we'll try and go for it next week, 1982. We'll try and see if we can only come up with 10 songs for then. Great talking to you.
All the best. Thank you.
Cheers.